Mark chapter 8, starting from verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spat on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking round." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, "Don't even go into the village." Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at the disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come with power."
Life can be pretty exhausting, can't it? I don't know about you, but my alarm will go off in around 13 hours. And once I hear that alarm, I've got another typical Monday ahead of me. Maybe for you, a typical Monday is a day at work. Another day of clients, of bosses, of meetings. Decisions that are inevitably either never taken or badly made. Stress and frustration. Or maybe for you, a Monday is a day at home with the children. And if your children are anything like mine, that'll be another day of chasing after them to come and get dressed and cries of more, more, no, no. It can be a grind, can't it? And sometimes it's even harder than that. Sometimes things can be so tough that the routine grind is actually something we long for. Well, if you're here today and you wouldn't consider yourself a Christian, first of all, let me say that you're very, very welcome. We're so, so glad to have you here with us. But allow me to ask you a question. You feel that grind, don't you? We seek after the thing we want, and even if we ever get it, how long before we seek after the next thing instead? And if we ever get that, how long before we either lose it or lose everything altogether? And in the end, as the saying goes, you can't take it with you. What if there was something that made the grind worth it? And Christians, what about you? Another morning, the grind of picking up that Bible. Another Wednesday evening, can't I just go home? Another time when those around you can't help but decry what they see as intolerance, but you know is what your God has said is right and proper and true. To all of us, is it worth it? We're going to look more closely now at that passage that John read for us, and it's my prayer that as we look at it, we would see that for people who know the fearsome, suffering King, not only is the grind worth it, but absolutely any price that he asks us to pay is a bargain. in September, we started our sermon series in Mark, and barely a chapter goes by without Jesus healing someone. A few highlights. In chapter 2, he made a paralyzed man walk. He made a paralyzed man walk. In chapter 3, he heals a man with what Mark calls a shriveled hand. And then in chapter 5, he meets a man whose daughter is sick, and then she dies. And his response is to tell the man, "Don't worry." And he goes to the girl, and he brings her back from the dead. He brings her back from the dead. Now here we have another healing in this passage, but with some big differences from what we've seen come before. Look down at the first part of our passage where we see the miracle, starting at verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he'd spat on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Now, did you notice how Jesus went about doing the miracle? It's not quite like anything we've seen from him before in Mark. He spit on the man's eyes. And culturally, that would have been as disgusting as we find it sitting here today. But Jesus, being regarded as a healer, would have been an exception to that distaste. The saliva of a powerful healer was seen to carry his healing power. It's a very clear signal that Jesus intends to heal this man. This isn't the first time in Mark that Jesus has healed with something other than a word. But look what happens next. End of verse 23. Jesus asks, "Do you see anything?" And the man replies, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." The man, who could see nothing at all a moment ago, can now see something of what's going on around him. And we can't miss, once again, Jesus has done something miraculous. His sight has gone from, I imagine, this to this. It's a miraculous change, but it's not really up to Jesus' reputation, is it? It doesn't sit that well with his track record. Jesus has taken the man outside the village to heal him. He's used his saliva, which would have been seen to have his healing power. He's asked the man if he can see, and the answer? Kind of. What happened? Jesus has completely healed so many people. He's even brought somebody back from the dead. And now we're getting kind of. Well, only for a moment. Look down at verse 25. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. The man is fully healed in the end. He can see. We don't even get a mere, then Jesus touched him and lo, he could see. We get three clear, unambiguous statements. His eyes were opened, his sight was restored, he saw everything clearly. And now again, let's just be clear about exactly what's happened here. He goes from seeing this to this and finally this. He started blind and in the end he could see. So what's with the step in between? Well, Jesus means for this miracle to teach us more than the fact that he can heal physical illness. This is the only one of Jesus' miracles across all four Gospels that works in this way, with two stages. Jesus does this quite intentionally and to teach us something. In the previous passage that we heard from last week, we see lots of allusions to seeing. For one thing, the disciples are warned to watch out, but it's clear that they can't see. It's hard to watch out when you can't see. The question we're left with after that passage is, what on earth is to be done about the disciples' blindness? And then Jesus comes, and he opens this blind man's eyes. What's to be done about the disciples' blindness? Well, we start to get an even fuller answer to that question as Jesus and the disciples go on their way, and we see Peter's confession. Look at verse 27. Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do people say I am?" And what he gets back is a wide range of opinions about who he might be. And in a sense, the answers we see here are all really positive ones. Some say he's John the Baptist, some say he's Elijah, some say he's one of the prophets. That's a veritable A-list of holiness, isn't it? But can you remember the very first verse of Mark's Gospel from all those weeks ago? the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. The Messiah, the Christ, the King, the Son of God. All those words that people around the disciples are applying to Jesus, all of those words that people around you are applying to him, they're a slap in the face. They fall indescribably short unless they also recognize him as King and Son of God, as Messiah. Any description of Jesus that stops short of those things is the highest of disrespect. Worse than that, it's blasphemy. And so it's not such a positive list after all. And all the way from Mark verse 1 to here, not a single human has recognized Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God. In fact, the only creatures that have used those terms have been unclean spirits in league with Satan. The evil ones recognize him, but healing after healing, miracle after miracle, teaching on teaching, not a single human gets it. Until verse 29. But what about you? Who do you say I am? Peter answered, the Messiah. Now, with words in a book, it's easy to gloss over huge, huge moments. So let's imagine this is a movie. The tension has been building up. Jesus has said his kingdom is coming, but everybody you'd want to be on board is really actively rejecting him. In fact, the only people who seem interested at all are pretty undesirable, actually. Who do you say I am? We get a montage of flashbacks as Peter thinks, Jesus proclaims, repent and believe the kingdom is near. He's more a king than King Herod. He fed God's people in the wilderness like Moses did. The score swells, not just piano, but strings, a kettle drum, sounding out heartbeat, gathering pace as Peter puts it together. More flashbacks. A girl brought back from the dead. The curse of sin and death defeated. Promises fulfilled. God's words through Isaiah the prophet. The eyes of the blind will be opened. The ears of the deaf unstopped. The lame leap. Your God will come. He will save you. And as the music reaches its crescendo, Peter answered, you are the Messiah. Yes, finally. What Mark stated plainly to us in the first verse of the book is on the lips of one of Jesus' followers. You are the Messiah. We were asking before, what on earth could be done about the disciples' blindness to who Jesus is? At the start of our passage today, in immediate answer to that question, Jesus opened a blind man's eyes so that he could see with clarity. And then we cut back to the disciples. What's to be done about their blindness? Jesus can open the eyes of the blind. Jesus can deal with the disciples' problem. And now, who do they say he is? The Messiah. Sight at last. Jesus has opened blind eyes. He's dealt with that problem. And before we press on, let's note that. It's Jesus' power that opens the eyes of the blind man. It's Jesus' power that opens Peter's eyes. And it's always thus. When it comes to your friends and your family, Jesus is the one who needs to open their eyes. Trust them to him. Pray to him. Call for him to open those blind eyes. So, we've seen the first eyes opened to Jesus after so much waiting and so much anticipation. What's going to come next? A new phase of Jesus' ministry opening the eyes of all he meets? A kingdom growing in strength until it rivals, surpasses Rome? Peace, prosperity, joy? We read on, and we see that that confession might actually be better described as a confusion. Look down from verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Jesus teaches what it truly means for him to be the Messiah. And it doesn't look at all like that new phase of ministry that we were just imagining. It looks much more like a failing kingdom than a flourishing kingdom. And that very fact is shocking The Messiah was supposed to be a conquering king, come in victory to make everything right for God's people. Jesus himself emphasizes those things in verse 31. He refers to himself as the Son of Man. Now, to our ear, that doesn't really sound like much, but back in Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man is shown to be a divine figure of authority, sovereignty, and dominion. Dominion over all things for all time. Jesus is saying that this figure of utter authority and dominion must suffer and die. The conquering Messiah, then, is also the suffering Messiah. How can both of those things be? Peter, who's just confessed Jesus as Messiah, is stunned. Verse 32, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Peter thinks that Daniel 7 is a comprehensive and awesome description of the Messiah. Sovereignty, dominion, power. When he hears from Jesus that the Messiah is in the business of suffering, rejection, and death, he's shocked to his core. What Peter's heard from Jesus is that the coming of the Messiah doesn't herald immediate victory for God's people. Jesus being there doesn't mean all of Peter's problems are suddenly going to go away. And I think that's what Peter wanted from Jesus. I think that's why he was so angry. In other words, Peter is more interested in his own expectations of what Jesus should be like rather than listening to Jesus to find out what he is like. If you're going to confess somebody as powerful king of the universe, you better be ready to listen to what they're going to say about themselves. And that goes for Christians today too. It's not for us to dictate to Jesus what he should be like, what he should do. Hard as it can be sometimes, it's for us to sit at his feet, to listen and to follow. Now, how will Jesus respond to being rebuked by Peter? Will gentle Jesus, meek and mild, say, "You've come a long way, I love you"? Will he have a one-to-one chat with Peter and teach him the error of his ways? Not a bit. Verse 33. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Get behind me, Satan. Wow. Now, I've thought about this, and I'm literally unable to come up with a stronger verbal rebuke that Jesus could have issued. He's essentially saying to Peter, "Get out of my presence, prince of evil." In fact, he's using the same word that he uses when he cast out demons earlier in the book. And that is a sharp rebuke, to say the least. Think again of Peter. A minute ago, we were so excited that he finally had sight. But now we can see that he got it so wrong that he deserves the sternest rebuke we can come up with. But if Jesus is the one who opens blind eyes and Peter's failing to see clearly, then surely Jesus just didn't get the job done. Peter's not completely blind any longer, but he certainly can't see with total clarity. Well, that sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? We're left with a question after the last passage: what's to be done about the disciples' blindness? And if we didn't have another scene in between, we'd be left with that same question. But we had the healing of the blind man. We had Jesus first restoring sight in part, and then all the way. Now we have Peter, seeing more than he did before, but demonstrating that to him, people look like trees walking around. Peter miraculously has newly opened eyes, like I said. But unlike the blind man, he's still in stage one of the miracle. Jesus is yet to lay on hands and restore sight completely. Peter sees like this. He can't see with clarity just yet. But for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, Jesus goes on to explain what his identity must mean in the lives of his followers. And in explaining, he issues the call. Jesus tells them, "I'm going to suffer and be rejected and die." And Peter objects strenuously. But look down at the last part of our passage from verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. And he said to them, truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come in power. Jesus is going to suffer and die, and he calls his followers to do the same. Now it's vital that we don't read verse 34 as saying any less than it does. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. The idea of take up your cross, we refer to by idiom in our culture. We speak of having a cross to bear. And when we do, it's usually something really trivial. And trivial is so, so far from what Jesus is saying here. The cross was the execution method of choice for the Romans in that place at that time. They used it to torture people to death. People's lungs filled with fluid, drowning the crucified person on dry land. The only way to get relief from that constriction was pushing down on legs, pulling up on arms that are nailed to the cross. Jesus is saying, with eyes open, choose your cross and be tortured to death. We can't miss how visceral this image would have been to its first hearers and readers. It's like saying to French royalty during the revolution, race to your guillotine. It's like saying to the German Jew in 1943, embrace your gas chamber. And to us today, the message is this: sacrifice like his is the Christian life. So follow him by choosing pain. As you speak the truth and are met with hate, follow him by choosing pain. As you sacrifice that holiday, that extra bedroom, that car, follow him by choosing pain. As you sacrifice time and energy caring for those around you with sacrificial love, follow him by choosing pain. Will you keep choosing for him, even when it hurts? You might be in a time of acute suffering right now, and if that is you, I'm so sorry to hear that that's the case. But be assured, he's asking you to do no more than he's done himself already. And to the one who answers that call, whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. The path that leads to Jesus is the one he walked himself. It's the only way home to him. Will you keep treading it for him as you make the journey home to him? Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross. As we close, I wonder if anyone here is thinking they might want to be his disciple. This is a call issued to you. Take up your cross. It's not the most attractive proposition in the world, is it? I'm the king who people think was supposed to come in power. I'm going to my death. Join me. It's actually pretty off-putting, isn't it, to say the least? What on earth could make someone want to respond to that invitation? For me, it would take a miracle. But a miracle is just what Jesus is offering. He is the one who can open blind eyes. What is it that Peter still needs his eyes open to? Not just the fact, but the wonder of a suffering Messiah, of a crucified Christ. Because fundamentally, it's not just that Jesus knows best who Jesus is. It's that Jesus knows best what we need. Opened eyes, healed hearts. Yes, we need someone who is strong to face down our enemies. We need a fearsome Daniel 7 Son of Man. But ultimately, we need more. We need a powerful king who loves us enough, not just to fight for us, but to die for us. And we need that because we've turned our backs on God. We've put ourselves on the throne. We've made ourselves, in doing that, his enemies. And in answer to our rebellion, his response was, out of love for you, to choose pain, choose sacrifice, and take up his cross. He is the one who is not just either one of strong and loving And not just a little of each. He is all of both, unstoppably strong, endlessly loving. So if you're someone who is interested in things of faith, in Christianity, in the church, if you're someone who wants to learn more about those things, here's a word for you. Don't. Don't. Don't seek out what people say. Don't think about intellectual arguments or find out about the history of the church. Seek this suffering king, the one whose subjects cling to him, even as we ourselves suffer. Find out about why he would come to this world of exhaustion and hunger and struggle, why he took up his cross for you. Jesus Christ is the burning heart of the Christian faith. He's the answer to a problem you might not even know that you have. And that problem's made clear in this passage. If anyone is ashamed of me, I will be ashamed of them. Those who reject him and live like he isn't king will be left outside his kingdom. Now, maybe that sounds mild, but be warned. If you're not a subject of the suffering king, you're an enemy of the powerful king. And that is not something to take lightly. He loves you. Run to him. Now, perhaps you're someone who loves Jesus already. It can be easy to forget the truth of who Jesus is, the lengths he was willing to go to save his people. If we're to take up our cross, we need to hear a reminder that the Jesus we follow is the one who came to suffer and die for us. I wonder if you're ever embarrassed by your king seeming so weak. It's not that he's weak. It's that he loves you. We must make sure we listen to Jesus about Jesus. Let's not listen to the culture around us as they make him out to be the weak or imaginary. Let's not even listen to ourselves as we're tempted to make him into the Jesus we'd have him be. He's your king who loved you to death. Don't be disappointed if your life sometimes looks like failure and pain. Not only did Jesus say that's exactly how it would feel, he spent his whole life on the walk to the cross. You're following in his way. You've joined him on that selfsame walk. That might be for you that you've got tomorrow another day of asking your child to listen and being told, no, no, no. Another day of knowing you should be teaching them everything you can about Jesus with every opportunity, but secretly wishing you could just have a break. If that's you, you haven't failed, and he hasn't failed you. You're following the suffering king of love. Maybe you're overlooked at work because of others' self-promotion and dishonesty, struggling to work for the Lord each day. Well, you haven't failed, and he hasn't failed you. You're following the suffering king of love. Struggling to cling on to hope through physical pain, through suffering, through feeling like you're worth less than when you were younger, finding it hard to listen to pray to speak of Jesus. You haven't failed, and he has not failed you. You're following the suffering king of love. We were thinking at the beginning about the grind that life is, toil and struggle and exhaustion. Is it worth it? We wondered. Jesus is the powerful king who reigns over all things. But his cross isn't something to stumble over like Peter. It's something to rejoice over. The powerful king who reigns over all, the one through whom and for whom all things were made, was willing to become the suffering king. When do we ever see a sovereign suffer and bleed and die for their subjects? Why would he do that? It's because whoever you are, he loves you with the realest love you'll ever know. Is it worth it? He is worth it.